This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A tragic anniversary upon us today.
Multiple capital injuries!
And it is 6:30 in the east, 3:30 in the west. And for those of you who are just joining us, this is a special report.
Take the building!
Attack. We are still taking metal, sharpened objects, missiles, to include bottles and rocks. And hand-thrown chemical-grade fireworks.
We are witnessing history and what can only be described as a national disgrace.
I'm mad because I love this country, and I think there's a group of people out there that are trying to destroy it. I don't care whether you're a liberal like me or a conservative or, you know, you're a moderate or whatever, or a Democrat, Republican. We all should care about protecting our democratic institutions, because if not, people are going to lose their voice.
1349 hours, declaring it a riot.
10:33, we're storming the Capitol. We've been
taken. As we come on the air, the U.S. Capitol is under lockdown after violent mobs, stoked and encouraged by the words of President Trump and his allies, stormed the building while the House and Senate were in session.
The fragility of democracy is this, that if we are not vigilant, if we do not defend it, democracy simply will not stand. It will falter and fail.
And so at this moment, we must decide, what kind of nation are we going to be? Are we going to be a nation that accepts political violence as a norm?
Mobilize in your own cities, your own counties, storm your own Capitol buildings.
Are we going to be a nation where we allow partisan election officials to overturn the legally expressed will of the people?
Where the f*** are they?
Are we going to be a nation that lives not by the light of the truth, but in the shadow of lies?
Start making a list, put all those names down, and we start hunting them down one by one.
The failed insurrection attempt on January 6th, 2021 happened in Washington, but it happened to all of us, and we are still living the aftermath. Today, we've invited back some of the voices we reflected with in the days after, and some who shouldered massive local responsibility in its aftermath. And we will welcome your calls a little later in the show. We begin, though, with Massachusetts Congressman and former Marine Seth Moulton, who was in his congressional office that afternoon and has been vocal since about the need for accountability, both for those who engaged in the insurrection that day and for former President Donald Trump, for his role in spreading the big lie. Congressman Moulton, who represents Salem and other communities in Massachusetts' 6th District, joins us now. Welcome back, Congressman.
It's good to be here, Tiziana. Thank you.
I'm glad you joined us. You know, that day, we weren't on air here at Radio Boston, so the station could take coverage from Washington. But later in the day, via cell phone from your office, you spoke with WBUR's All Things Considered. I actually want to play a little bit of that conversation for you. Here it is.
Hold on. My Capitol Police are rapping at my door. I've not heard back.
How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
You know about 1100? Ways and means?
Yeah.
The briefing for the
Okay, right there? Okay, thank you. Yep. Thank you. So we're just getting called into a briefing care of the Capitol Police. So I'm going to go to that now.
Take us back there, Congressman, what you experienced that day in your head, in your gut.
The biggest word that comes to mind is just surprise or shock. I mean, when I started the day, I saw the Capitol Police doing their morning formation, assembling as if it were going to be a small protest. There weren't that many officers. They didn't have any special riot gear. They didn't seem particularly well organized. And what happened just a few hours later was something that none of us could ever imagine, something that I frankly expected as a U.S. Marine in Iraq, but never even dreamed of happening as a United States congressman in America. When this mob instigated by the president came up Capitol Hill and started swarming the buildings, including my building, just yards from the Capitol itself, directly across the street, I went into the out of the hallway, I guess putting my old Marine hat on, and just tried to assess the security. And what I saw was nothing different than any average day at the Capitol. A few officers guarding the front of the building, almost nobody in the halls. I realized how vulnerable we were. And when I got that rap at the door, at first I wasn't even sure if it was the Capitol Police or perhaps the protesters coming down the hall. The first time they came and knocked, and they said, you know, get your things. You need to go to this safe room. And I had one staff room with me that day because we were so light due to COVID. I said, well, I'm not going without him. He's going to come with me. I'm not going to leave him to the mob. And so we went down to this room that quickly became filled with hundreds of members of Congress.
I was struck by you saying to the Capitol Police officer there that you were okay. I get it. You're a former Marine. You've been through a lot. I'm not okay. A year later, I feel like we're not okay. Are you really okay? And are you still struggling with the aftermath of that day at all?
You know, I've been someone who's been very vocal about sharing my experience with post-traumatic stress coming out of Iraq. Look, the simple answer is that I've been through worse overseas, so I don't have post-traumatic stress in a sense from that experience. I know a lot of my colleagues do. They don't have the difficult history of service overseas that I have. And for many of them, it was the worst day of their lives. But in terms of a broader question, am I okay? I think I'm less okay today than I was then. Because by the end of that day, Tiziana, we actually had bipartisan consensus on making sure this never happened again. And to hear someone as often reprehensible as Mitch McConnell come out and denounce his president, denounce the violence, and say, this can never happen again, that was actually encouraging. And so January 6th was a very, very dark day, but I went into January 7th with a little bit of optimism. And that optimism that we are going to fix this, that we're going to learn a lesson, that America won't let this happen again, that's evaporated because I think it could happen again the next time we have election, because we've done nothing to prevent it.
There are a number of threads there I want to pick up on, and we'll go to break in a minute and come back and add David Gergen to this conversation. I'm really looking forward to that. I'm glad you're staying with us. Before the break, I do want to ask you, I want to stay just in this day today for just a second longer and ask you, what has been most important to you to do today in order to observe this 1 year mark?
It's been to try to remind whoever will listen that we can't forget this. You know, there's a group of Americans who are disgusted by what happened. There's a group of Americans who want to sweep it under the rug and pretend it never happened. But sort of human nature is to want to move on and to be optimistic and just look towards the future. But if we don't actually change things, change laws, change practices, change the beliefs of almost 70% of Republicans in America today who still believe the lie that the 2020 election was stolen. If we don't change those things, then I fear another January 6th in 2022, this November. I fear another one in 2024. This can happen again. And there are actually people around the country who are preparing for that. So let's not forget.
We are marking today 1 year since the failed insurrection at the U.S. Capitol while Congress was attempting to certify the 2020 presidential election. Join our conversation. What are you thinking about the nation, your neighbors, on this day? Are you scared about our democracy, worried about 2022, 2024? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Still with us, Congressman Seth Moulton of the 6th District, which includes Burlington and other communities. Congressman, you sure gave me a lot to think about before the break. Thanks for staying with us.
This is important, and you know, we need to talk about this today. So I'm glad to be
here. So Let's do some more of that. Also joining us now, David Gergen. He has advised four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He is also the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he's a professor. David, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, it's good to be here with you and with Seth Moulton.
David, I'm just going to start. I know you heard Congressman and Moulton and I talk before the break, and I want to give you a chance to react to what you heard.
Sure. Well, I thought Seth was very much on target in his concerns and asking for accountability, and that we not walk away from this incident as if it never happened, because it is so important to the future of our democracy. I think what worries me the most, and I'm deeply concerned about it, is that by now I thought we would have come to grips with what happened on January 6th, that the country would have unified, generally speaking, about the importance of avoiding violence in our politics. Those of us who go back to the 60s remember how we almost got torn apart by the assassinations of that period. And the violence now would be even more dangerous. But, you know, the truth is, I think we're slipping backwards, and I don't think we're going forwards. It's interesting how many voices are now rising, both in the United Kingdom in particular. There's been a lot of conversation in the UK about, is America headed toward a civil war? But increasingly, that's being heard here in this country. Timothy Snyder, who wrote a very good book on tyranny, was on the air last night at CNN, and he went on at some length about the dangers to democracy that are arising. This could slip away from us. It is not ordained that we should have a successful democracy. You know, they've never lasted in history, and it could be our turn to go down. I don't think so. I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're right on the edge.
So Congressman Moulton, there's, you know, David Gergen saying we are slipping backward rather than moving forward. Before the break, you said, I think in some ways I'm less okay now than I was a year ago. I think you both thought we would, to use David's phrase, come to grips with January 6th and the aftermath. What would it take to come to grips with this as a country?
Well, first of all, I think David's hit the nail on the head, unsurprisingly. And in full disclosure, I wouldn't be in this job without his inspiration and encouragement. So, David, it's an honor to be on with you.
You're the brave patriot here, not me.
Well, the reality is that the bravest patriots are those Republicans who are actually standing up to the president and the former president. And they're so few and far between. Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, Peter Meyer. I mean, you can count them on almost one hand who are actually willing to speak out and say, we have to come together. We have to come to grips with this. I think that coming to grips with it means that Republicans and Democrats agree to do something about it. It's not enough just for Democrats to say we have to save our democracy. We've got to get Republicans to say what they know is true in private, that Joe Biden is our duly elected president, and yet are too afraid to say in public.
I'm really struck by that, David, especially you having served Republican and Democratic administrations, having been engaged in Washington and politics for so long. To hear the number of times I've heard over the last year people say we have to get Republicans to say in public what they believe in private.
Yep. I was encouraged this morning. It's just one small little ray of sunlight. But there's a column by Karl Rove, who, you know, of course, was confidant with George W. Bush. And he has a column saying that Republicans have got to call this out. They have to see that this is an act of terrorism. And they ought to speak up because our democracy depends on it. It was exactly the right message to hear from a Republican. You know, and we don't hear from many of them, but Karl Rove does have a lot of cachet within the Republican Party. I wonder if the Republican Party is going to begin to split over issues like this the way the Democratic Party has split so often in the last few months, because it's going to make our politics a lot more complicated. If there's a moderate, quote, moderate conservative wing represented by a Karl Rove, that would be progress. But we need to bring the rest along, too. And I think it's a question of changing our culture, our political culture, And to me, one of the most important advances we're going to make is by bringing new people into leadership roles, especially people who've served in the military. I have found Seth was a forerunner on this. He was right at the cutting edge of encouraging more veterans to run for Congress. And we have now 25, 30 more now from both sides of the aisle who are willing to work together. That's the kind of progress I think needs to be steady. It takes a long time. But if we can change our culture, we can change our politics.
I'm going to go to the phone. So many people calling in, 1-800-423-8255, to add your voice. We actually have a caller in Miami, Florida. Joe's listening to us down in Miami. Joe, go ahead.
Hi. First, I want to say thank you, Congressman Semper Fi. I was a Marine in D.C. when Dr. King was assassinated. I understand what it's like for the Capitol to be in that situation, but I don't remember one of those protesters bringing weapons against me and my fellow Marines in those streets. I want to say that your office is one of the few offices that ever answers the phone. It is like crickets when you call the DNC. I don't think I've ever received a call back from them. And the messaging, as I said to the producer, the messaging coming from Midas Touch, the Lincoln Project, Republican voters against Trump, is far more effective. And I think the American people need to be educated as to what propaganda can do, and also some focus on what will happen to this country if what we've seen in democracies elsewhere. I've traveled all over the world, and I've seen this in Indonesia, the Philippines, now in Nicaragua. We see what Ortega is doing. And I think a number of Americans are simply not aware as to what happens when democracy is lost. And I thank you for
Joe,
the time.
Thanks. Well, thanks for the call. Congressman, go
thank
ahead.
You. I appreciate the comments, Joe. What I think is important for the American people to remember here is that while physically this was an assault on Congress, and those are the images that we'll see replayed today on the airwaves and in here on shows like this, physically it was an assault on Congress, but principally it was an assault on the American people. You know, the idea that people with guns and power can change an election to the result that they want, that's just not a democracy. That's what dictatorships do. That's what they do in places like Russia and China. That's not America. And so these violent insurrectionists, they were attacking the American people, including the American people in states like Georgia that we like to think of are generally red Republican states. Obviously, Georgia is a place that's changing. But look, the people of Georgia voted a certain way. The people in power wanted to change that and say that it doesn't matter what the people of Georgia said. It doesn't matter what votes they cast. We're going to change that result to support this old president.
I'm going to grab one more call here, 800-423-8255. We have Beth in Framingham. Beth, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you to you and your guests. And my particular concern as a historian and as a parent is how our kids are learning about this in school, and particularly even whether they're able to get an unbiased view of this, given the crackdown on critical race theory and other concerns. So as a parent, I've talked to my own kids, but we really need to present this in a really straightforward fashion for the next generation, and I feel like that's going to be a key way that we keep this from happening in the future.
Beth, I appreciate that call. I'm going to pick up on that, David Gergen, and just say I want to believe, especially as somebody who hosts a local regional radio program, right, that we can be in dialogue with each other in ways that make us better, whether it's what we're teaching our children or how we're talking to our neighbors. And I want to believe that there are conversations we can have even across these divides, neighbor to neighbor, that move us forward. How do we, am I wrong? And how do we do that?
I think you're absolutely right. It's that having difficult conversations is an important road into the future, because all of us know that there are tensions, anxieties, there are hatreds that are unexpressed, you know, publicly, but in private. You know, people let loose, and we need to encourage environments in our various institutions, our churches, our synagogues, and elsewhere, you know, places of faith, is one of the places that I think we can best have some of these kind of conversations. Strikingly enough, what we know from research is that if people sort of work together, if you put a group of people from different religious backgrounds in the same room together and ask them to talk about their religious differences, by the end of the conversation, things are worse, not better. But if you put the people who come to a gathering like that, and you put them out, you know, building Habitat for Humanity for a day and a half, building a house, they work together, and then when they sit down, it's like the military. They respect each other, and their differences begin to disappear. That's one of the reasons the military is such a successful institution these days, is it has learned how to have people of different, very different faiths and backgrounds work together. But we haven't extended that to our civil life in the way we need to do that. And I do think that starts in the schools, but it doesn't end there. It's a project of a lifetime.
So, Seth Moulton, I'm going to come back to you. Earlier in the show, I played you a little sound from the conversation you had on All Things Considered while the insurrection was happening. I want to play a little bit more sound from there. You were talking with WBUR's Lisa Mullins, and you were reading her a text that you had written to a Republican member of the House who you did not want to identify, who was objecting to the results of the election. Here that is.
I'll just read what I said to him. I said, "With all due respect, the utter lawlessness outside the Capitol, which reminds me of Iraq or a Soviet satellite state, is what you and your colleagues' actions inside the Capitol are inspiring and supporting. How can you say this is good for the future of our democracy?"
In that interview, you hadn't heard back from that person yet. I think I want to ask you two things. One, are you at a point now where you would tell us who you were trying to talk to? And two, have you had successful dialogue in the 12 months since with anyone on the GOP side of the House about this past year?
Well, let me start with the second question, because it's been very difficult. I won't say I haven't had any successful dialogue, but I have worked very hard. I've actually put a lot of personal time and effort into trying to get some of the people who I know believe the truth to just come out and say it. And I've proposed different ways that we could join and joint-led resolutions and other things, just to make a symbolic gesture to say that was wrong. And yet I've had very limited success. And sadly, the person that I texted, this colleague, who I used to really think of as a good friend, I haven't been successful with him, but I haven't given up. And that's why I'm not going to share his name, because I haven't given up on him yet. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I didn't know you weren't done. I want to hear this.
I think the future of our democracy depends on convincing fundamentally good people like him to have the courage to tell the truth. And I won't say his name, but he actually has a distinguished record of service to this country in different ways. And he knows the truth. I feel like if I can't convince him to get out there and say that we can't do this again, then that makes me very pessimistic about our future. So I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep working on it.
So I'm going to ask the two of you together, and I welcome you to talk to each other, over me, over each other, to answer this. What do we do now? What is imperative and possible in the next 3, 6, 9 months? And I guess I want to keep it in that time frame because I want to stay shy of the 2022 election. What can we do, and what can we do now to move forward together?
David, you should start.
David, maybe. Yeah.
Well, I think the likelihood is it's going to get worse, especially as we head into the 2022 elections. They'll be extremely competitive. You know, power could pass from one party to the other. That power that passes to the Republicans could well remain in power for the next 10 years. I think the most important thing is not only to fight a good fight in the elections, but the Democrats are up against the wall. They need to get their voters out in massive numbers. And I know that the large numbers of constituents are exhausted right now. It's not just this. It's the pandemic and, you know, the price of gasoline and all these other things that have made the country so anxious and so distrustful of our leaders. I think it would be an interesting question. You know, if we all want to live well together. Joe Biden gave perhaps the most forceful speech of his presidency today, and it was very, very, he put the blame squarely on Trump for everything that's been going wrong on January 6th. It was a tough speech. Was that a wise choice? I think there are a lot of Democrats who think, thank God, he finally went out there and really said what needed to be said. I can tell you the healing process just got more complicated, too. So, you know, I don't know exactly. I think we have to feel our way along and experiment with various things to see. Did Joe Biden make a wise choice, Seth? Was it the right thing to do at this moment when, you know, we thought we were going to come into this January 6th and have a moment of healing? Was it the right thing?
Well, I'm not sure, because I don't believe you can have real reconciliation until you have accountability. And that has to include Donald Trump, who so far has gotten off scot-free. I mean, he almost held a press conference celebrating the insurrection of January 6th today. But the timing is difficult because we're running out of time to have accountability before we have reconciliation. And there's a lot of accountability to be dished out here. And I'm grateful that the January 6th committee is doing their work. Even more grateful that a few brave Republicans have taken part in it. But we also have to look ourselves in the mirror a little bit as Democrats and say, if we're on the right side of history, we're on the right side of democracy, we're on the right side of the truth, why is it that we're barreling towards losing the midterm elections? What are we failing to do to bring the American people along with us? I think we all have to look ourselves in the mirror and say, what do we need to do better as Americans? And that can't be simply a process of blaming the other side.
I agree with that totally. That's some acceptance on your own side of where we've gone wrong, what we should have done better. And that obviously starts with Republicans, but it does not exclude the Democrats.
I mean, that's what I'm asking myself when I say, why can't I convince this person I think is not just a colleague, but fundamentally a good American? Why can't I convince him to do the right thing here, to speak the truth, to speak the truth to power, to vote to certify the will of the American people? It used to be so simple that we never thought twice about whether Congress would do the right thing. But now we have to think about it. And so I'm thinking myself, what more can I do? I'm not just going to sit here and blame Trump and the Republicans. We all need to stand up as Americans and fight this fight together.
Last thought to you, David Gergen.
Well, I think increasingly the answer may be prayer. we're having such a hard time bringing people together in reasonable ways. And I don't know where we meet in the middle. I'm not sure there is a middle very much. We have to rebuild it. But I think one of the things I, again, come back to Seth is he represents part of our future. He and other people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and taking off their uniforms, they really can help this country, and I think they can give people more hope. When veterans can come back and, you know, they fought under the same flag and then they can work under the same flag when they come home, I think that could do a lot, just as a John McCain did. To encourage respect for the other side.
And on that note, I really want to thank both of you. That we just heard David Gergen, advisor to U.S. Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He is the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School, where he's on faculty. David, thank you.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you, Seth.
And Congressman Seth Moulton. I know you had a fixed time window where you could join us today. I appreciate you making it work. Congressman Moulton represents the 6th District. Thanks and take good care.
Tiziana, thank you.
And we are engaged in this hour in such a reflection about the attempted insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th this last year. Many argue that it started with the big lie. And we have been following along with voices who joined us in those early days. Before the break, we finished a conversation with presidential advisor David Gergen and Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. And one of the last things they talked about was accountability. Well, over the last 12 months, hundreds have been arrested and charged in connection with the insurrection, including nearly a dozen from New England, 6 from Massachusetts. And yet that's a fraction of those who breached the Capitol that day. And as investigations by law enforcement and Congress continue, it's become clear that there was coordination and planning, at least by and for some of the participants behind that breach of the Capitol. So we want to finish on accountability. Join the conversation. Have enough and have the right people been held accountable for what happened on the 6th? Will they be? What happens if they aren't? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. With us now about what the future may hold and accountability in the moment. First, we have Joan Donovan, Research Director at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy, who is an expert on extremism. Joan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Andrew Lelling, former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts in the Trump administration. Lelling coordinated with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia on prosecutions. Andrew, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, good to be here.
So, Joan, I'm going to start here this with a statement from Congressman Jake Auchincloss, speaking at an event hosted by the Charles River Regional Chamber last night. Here it is.
This is not a day to be consecrated and inscribed into the history books and reflected upon and speechified about. This is current events. This is happening now. We are in the middle of a constitutional crisis where the majority of the GOP thinks that the election was stolen in 2020.
Are we in the middle of something, Joan? And if so, what do you think it is?
We've been in the middle of something, and that's sadly the reality of the political situation. You know, for those who are listening, I research internet communication and the ways in which disinformation, misinformation travels, and it's really hit a fever pitch over the last couple of years. But especially as we talk about elections, and it goes all the way from the local to the national, and even globally, we're seeing these trends where those who have control of the communication infrastructure can set pretty well different kinds of political and public agendas. And so we have to reflect on the fact that, yes, it's currently happening. And the more that people who are fed lies and disinformation that already believe that the election has been stolen, they're ready to mobilize. They're ready to do something about it. January 6th, unfortunately, was just the first shot across the bow.
Andrew Lelling is somebody who really recently was charged with, you know, law enforcement, prosecuting if people make such attempts, stopping things from happening. What do you think when you hear Joan Donovan react like that?
Well, I've got two sort of general observations. One is that of the people who breached the Capitol back in January of 2021, they should be prosecuted down to the last man or woman. The rule of law has to prevail, and I think the department's doing a pretty good job of doing that. Looking ahead, my predictions are slightly less dire. I think it's easy to forget that the people who breached the Capitol that day were an extremely self-selected set of supporters of President Trump. You know, that was a Stop the Steal rally. People traveled from far and wide. Think about the level of motivation needed to show up in the first place. And then some even more extreme subset of that group breached the Capitol. And so while the event is appalling, I do not extrapolate to the public as a whole from that event. I think that people like us obsess about these events. I think most of the country, frankly, is past it. I don't think that formal proceedings in Washington are going to change that. So I think most of the public may be slightly out of sync with us. I think most of the public thinks that it was terrible, but is not worried on a day-to-day basis about it happening again. And I think in a very preliminary way, the recent elections, both of which were close in Virginia and New Jersey, which proceeded without violence and without loud cries of fraud afterward, I think give you a little bit of hope that things will return somewhat back to normal in that regard.
Joan Donovan, let me just let you react to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's unfortunately in the research that we do, I do agree that it is a small but highly, highly engaged and coordinated group of people that set about that day knowing they were going to storm the Capitol. And when you get large crowds of people with other, frankly, let's call them insurrectionists, amidst, they do, you know, use the cover of the crowd to do such things. But we saw with the Stop the Steal crowd several attempts to storm other state capitals and to get inside and to disrupt votes in the lead up to this. And what we know about social movements is they have these moments of abeyance. There's going to be, you know, they're going to be tied up in court cases. They're going to be using more clandestine communication apps like Telegram. But they are, you know, in our estimation, the research that we're doing, they're very angry, and they do see other, not just elections, but other opportunities in the future to come back together stronger. What's missing right now, of course, is Trump from the discourse, and Trump was able to animate so much belief that, he could change the winds of the election if more people showed up at the Capitol. We are missing that component. It's very important for social movements to have, you know, a political person on the inside that makes them think they can win. And so until such time that we see things tilt in that favor, and I'm not saying things go back to Republicans, I'm saying it's Trump, right? Trump is a very unique fixture in this part of our political world. And so I'm cautious, but not as optimistic.
So I seven different directions I want to go at once. Andrew Lilling, I'm going to turn back to you, and I want to ask you, in investigating people who participated and in prosecuting, you know, Joan is painting a very specific picture here based on the research she's done. I'm also struck by the sort of party bus attitude that we saw, you know, among some of the participants as well. I'm thinking about the coverage of Mark Sahadi and Suzanne Ayani, members of Super Happy Fund America, who are two of the people prosecuted from Massachusetts. You know, buses heading down there. This continuum of America, some seeing this as one of the most abhorrent moments in our American history, and others seeing it as an opportunity to be a part of something. How does one draw the distinction between that and criminality in prosecuting, especially among local participants from the New England area?
Well, it is, the situation has its complexities, but I think you have to keep in mind that before the event, no one anticipated that happening except for a tiny fraction of true militant extremists who went down there hoping for violence and looking for ways to make it happen. So all the people piling onto the buses, they just think they're going to a rally. They don't think they're going down there to participate in a seminal criminal event. And I think that's important to keep in mind. Now, those who, despite going down there just thinking they're participating in a rally, but wind up participating in the breach of the Capitol, they should be prosecuted. They are, you know, adults with personal agency. They're responsible for their own behavior, and they should be prosecuted. But, you know, the party atmosphere was perfectly understandable at the time. You had a lot of people on the Republican side who believed that the election was illegitimate. And so going down there to express that publicly with Trump leading the way with a speech made perfect sense if that was your belief. And it's only after the fact that it looks insane to have done so.
So I want to go to the phones for a second. 1-800-423-8255. We'll hear from Nick in Natick. Nick, go ahead.
Hi. I've got kind of got two things that are working together. Basically, it seems like there's a standard of what they allow to be said on TV, whether it's commercials or news, has really gone down, and basically people can lie. I remember when I was a kid, if you saw a commercial that wasn't true, they would pull it off the air. You might see it once, and then you wouldn't be able to see that commercial again. And I think that mixed with social media and just the echo chamber and what people are consuming, I don't know how we get away from that, how this doesn't just keep intensifying like it's been doing the last several years.
Thanks for that call, Nick. I don't know that the laws around commercials and falsification of information on commercials have changed, but Joan Donovan, certainly the spread of misinformation via social media is something that we are really dealing with now. How important is the social space, and how has that changed?
Yeah, Nick is absolutely right. Nick understands, on cable and broadcast especially, you had to be very careful. This is why we saw Lou Dobbs, for instance, have to walk back his comments about the big lie. We saw Newsmax have to make an apology after airing an interview with Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy. So if you in media make an apology or a retraction, like we see at the back page of the paper, then that's considered okay. You've made good. But with social media, of course, you can say anything you want. And so then you start to see this gray area where if you're on the news and you're just quoting someone on social media, that's reporting news. And, and maybe the quote sounds like news, but it's really planting misinformation and disinformation into more public arenas. And so you've seen some people try to get more accountability around that by saying, hey, we want our news to be free from this kind of political influence. But unfortunately, it's really hard to hold anybody to account. And I know that's the theme of this moment on the show. And unfortunately, social media really changes the game for how reporting is done.
And does it change the game for how prosecution is done, Andrew Lelling? We have six people in Massachusetts charged in connection with January 6th. One of those cases, Brian McCreary, is closed. How does social media fit into prosecution, investigation?
I can say from the prosecution side, social media is a huge problem. Social media has absolutely turbocharged extremist movements and has contributed to political polarization by allowing people to simply choose what they are going to consume when it comes to news. And that could be reliable news, not reliable news. They can choose precisely what fits their own philosophical predilections. And so they're all in their own little bubbles, and it's easier than ever to coordinate with fellow extremists online. We've seen that over the course of several years on the law enforcement side, how rapidly extremist groups coalesce and then can coordinate their actions. And when I was United States Attorney, I'd often felt like you were a referee, meaning you would see this constant barrage of hostile commentary on social media. And you had to decide what crossed the line into an actionable threat, something that was a crime, and what was just political commentary in our ever-coarsening environment. That was very difficult to do. And over the last few years, you can see some of the choices we made in that regard. But social media is a tremendous issue when it comes to monitoring threats to the public and trying to figure out what to do with them.
So, Joan Donovan, picking up on two things that Andrew Lelling just said, he talked about social media turbocharging these movements. And also, there's a line of judgment about what crosses over. So I wonder, one, reflect on the turbocharging. And I know you've done a lot of work recently on memes and their role in turbocharging messages. And two, are those who are really organizing with nefarious intent, are they savvy about that line? Do they know how to walk up to it and not cross it?
Yeah, they certainly know how to create a market for information. And so if you think about things like build the wall, lock her up, jobs not mobs, stop the steal, release the Kraken, they all have similar things in common, which is that they're memes, they're all three-word phrases, some of them rhyme. And the point of that is to make it memorable. And to, the point of coordination, though, what it does is it allows these extremist groups to find each other online, similar to the way that other movements like Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter or Standing Rock have been able to organize online. However, what we see that's different about these extremist groups is they will go really above and beyond to be incredibly resilient to platform moderation. They will know not to use certain racial slurs. They will create their own language and their own sets of phrases in order to make sure and also create backup channels so that they can stay on the more public platforms like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. And then they'll often be running a side chat, you know, on a less well-known service like Zello, for instance, which there was some great reporting on by WNYC and Michael Loewinger. And unfortunately, we're in this multi-platform environment where law enforcement is going to have to look across all of these spaces to do their monitoring. But the general public might not even know that they're immersed in groups online that contain extremists that are coordinating right under the cover. And unfortunately, when we see organization of groups like Stop the Steal, they track right back to folks like Roger Stone and Steve Bannon. And so we're,
former Trump advisors.
Former Trump advisors. And we're in this moment where we're trying to think about, well, what is our online world going to look like after January 6th of last year? I think that moment, January 6th, was an incredibly important moment in internet history because that's when platform companies really went at these accounts, and they removed a ton of these accounts. But unfortunately, it doesn't necessarily break up the groups because they're planning for that already.
So, Andrew Lelling, we have about 30 seconds left. Most important step over the next year in accountability for January 6th?
The most important step in accountability is being taken already, which is that the Justice Department continues to aggressively prosecute everyone involved. Those cases have been proceeding as they should. The sentences have made sense. And at the end of that process, the department should release to the public statistics and figures about who was prosecuted, how many convictions, and what they got. That's what the public wants to see. And I think so far has confidence in that process as it's been going on. So hopefully that will continue.
All right. That is Andrew Lelling, former U.S. attorney for Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Joan Donovan, Research Director at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Policy. Thank you, Joan.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beland. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. Thanks for listening and calling today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.